Okay, so good morning everyone, we'll get started. So this class we're going to do Parasha. Next week's class, being that it's on Hanukkah, we'll talk a little bit about some of the themes of Hanukkah as we get into the holidays, and also tonight's class is going to discuss that too for anybody who's interested. It's a couples class tonight at 8 o'clock on the topic of Hanukkah. But today we're going to talk about this week's Parasha. This week we begin the great story of Yosef and his brothers. Yosef and his brothers is the longest story in the Torah. Hands down. Spans, Vayeshev, Miketz, Vaygash, Vayechi, spans four parashiyot. Tremendous amount of detail. We have studied this from when we're young. We study it when we're old. It's a fascinating story. So many different characters, so many different players. And we're really going to be consumed by it for the next month or so in shul. Every single week you're going to hear more about Yosef and his brothers. But the end of parasha of Sefer Bereshit, the last four parashiyot which deal with Yosef and his brothers, is really a different kind of parasha. Until this point, we've been dealing a lot with the nation, formulating the nation of Israel, and really the covenant of Hashem, who's going to be God's chosen person to make the berit. We now transition into a really new topics, so to speak, with the end of Bereshit. We don't hear any more about Berit covenant. We don't hear any more about God coming to people and saying, I'm going to take care of you and you're going to have kids like the stars in the sky and sand in the sea. All of that language is behind us. We're really up to now formulating the actual nation. We have the 12 sons of Yaakov, and we're really going to talk about the building blocks of creating a new people. And this is really what I think Parashat Vayeshev starts with and really looks towards the future of what's going to be with this nation of Am Yisrael. So what I want to do in this class is to look a little bit in a broad sense at the parasha, a number of different stories, and then we're going to zoom in on one particular story that I think is going to teach us a lot about the parasha as a whole. And really, when you look at this week's parasha in general, there's two characters that stand out. Which two characters really rise to the top and we have stories about them? Yosef and Yehuda. So let's start with Yosef. Yosef really goes through a roller coaster ride in this week's parasha. We have three separate stories in which Yosef rises to prominence. He's a very important person. And then we find him get thrown down in a very sudden and difficult way. The first of those stories opens the parasha with Yaakov favoring his son Yosef, giving him the ketonet pasim. What is a ketonet pasim? What is that? The coat of what?
Many colors.
Of course, the coat of many colors, right? Broadway has influenced us tremendous, and Camp David has taken it. But there's an interesting, Rashi actually explains better. Pasim, some people understand it as stripes. The word pas can sometimes mean stripes. But Rashi understands it a little differently. He understands a pas is the palm of a person's hand. Pas hayad. The coat, the sleeves of the coat went past the palm of the hands. Why is that important? Because what does that symbolize? That the person is not working. He doesn't work. His coat passes his hand. He doesn't have his hands available to him. He doesn't need to work. This was a symbol. Yosef was the overseer of his brothers. He didn't do the work himself. He watched as his brothers did the work. And that creates a lot of resentment and animosity amongst the brothers. We're young, we're older than him, and we have to work, and he gets to oversee. And so that leads to a tension between the brothers. So Yosef is on high, the brothers are underneath, and Yosef is riding the wave. So that's the first story. As a result of that, the brothers sell Yosef into slavery, and Yosef is quickly taken down from his pedestal and his perch, and he's sold as a slave. He goes from the leader of the house of Yaakov to a slave boy in Mitzrayim in the house of Potiphar, and so he gets a real reality check in that. But, yes.
So, at the point where it says over here that he had the dream and he told, why would he tell his brothers the dream?
We're going to talk about that. Okay. It's a good question. It's basically, you're kind of screaming as you're reading the text. You're like yelling at Yosef, what are you doing? Why are you telling them the dream? Yosef is out of touch a little bit. He's not reading the situation appropriately, or he's maybe doing it. He feels like, why should the brothers be upset? This is what it is, right? And he's not taking their feelings into consideration a little bit. That's going to be part of Yosef's growth curve over here. And so, lo and behold, yeah.
Why was he the man that didn't work? Why did they choose Yosef?
His father, most likely because... Yeah, most likely because he's the oldest son of Rachel, his most beloved wife, and Rachel has died, and so Yosef, he feels, is the one that he has the closest relationship to as a result of his relationship with Rachel. That's most likely the answer to that. He could have also seen other things in Yosef that maybe caused him to rise. The Torah tells us ki ben zikunim hulo, because he was a ben zikunim, and there's a few different interpretations what it means that he was a ben zikunim. Some people say because from the word zaken, he was like that child that the parent has at the very end of his life that, you know, gives him that re-energizes his life. So you could look at it that way. Others, the Targum over here says bar hakim, he was incredibly intelligent and smart. And so it could be that Yaakov rose him to prominence because he saw in him an early signs of intellect and real knowledge. So there's a few different reasons that it could be. So now Yosef gets down to the house of Potiphar in story number 2, and he's a slave boy. And again, we see that he's successful. He rises up to the top. If you look on page 1, Pasuk 5, under story number 2, it tells us, and from the time that the Egyptian put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed his house for Joseph's sake, so that the blessing of the Lord was upon everything that he owned in the house and outside. So everything that Yosef has, like the Midas touch, everywhere he goes, things are turning out great. Every time he's put into a position of prominence, everyone else around him is very successful and is growing and producing tremendously. And God is blessing everybody as a result of Yosef. But again, just like in the first story where Yosef suddenly meets his match and is thrown down, the same happens in the house of Potiphar. He meets the wife of Potiphar, who tries to seduce him. Yosef resists the temptation, but as a result of that, he ends up being thrown into what the text calls a pit. Very interesting that they refer to the jail as a pit, as the first story was, he was also thrown into a pit. The Torah is trying to hint to you, all of these stories are happening over and over again. Yosef rises, he's thrown into the pit, and now he's all the way in the jail, once again on the lowest rung of society, in the jail in Egypt. What happens when he's in the jail in Egypt? Third story, he again rises to power. If you look at page number 2 in the story number 3, it says, the chief jailer put in Joseph's charge all the prisoners who were in that prison, and he was the one to carry out everything that was done there. The chief jailer did not supervise anything that was in Joseph's charge, because the Lord was with him, and whatever he did, the Lord made him successful. Again, same pattern. Yosef rises to prominence, albeit this time in the jail, but he nevertheless is an important person in the jail. He oversees everything in the jail. The jail is quote-unquote successful as a result of that. The people like him. Everything is going very nicely for him. And that's sort of how the parasha ends. We're going to see that in next week's parasha, Yosef is now taken out of that, and he ends up becoming the secondary in command in Egypt. So the question is, we notice a pattern going on in the life of Yosef. Yosef starts out, he goes up tremendously, he climbs, he's very successful, and then at the peak of his success, he goes straight down, and he ends up getting thrown down into a pit or into whatever kind of situation on the lowest rungs of society, only to be taken up and down and up and down, 3 different instances in this week's parasha. And so the question begs to be asked, what are we to make of this repetition? Why is this happening over and over again to Yosef? It's a sort of Groundhog Day that is occurring to Yosef. Here we go. Same situation, same fallout. What is going on with Yosef? What is happening in these stories from story to story that we need to understand about why this is happening to Yosef? And what are we supposed to learn? What was Yosef supposed to learn? What is the reader supposed to learn about these stories that are happening to Yosef? And so that's a broad look at Yosef's role in this week's parasha in 3 different stories. Any questions on that? Okay. So I think the key to unlocking Yosef's story is actually unlocking another story in this week's parasha. A story that gets wedged right in between all of the stories of Yosef. And I don't think that that's a coincidence. It's the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Now the story of Yehuda and Tamar may not be familiar to everyone. Probably because schools today don't really teach it. When most of the time you learn Bereshit when you're in somewhere between 1st and 4th grade. the content of the story of Yehuda and Tamar, by some people's admission, is not for first to fourth grade appropriate. And so many schools, and I guess rightfully so, I'm not going to make a judgment, they skip that chapter. Problem is, nobody ever comes back to that chapter. They just skip it, and it becomes this little void. Chapter 38 in Bereshit is this, like, cloud over it that nobody ever studies it, and nobody knows what's going on over there in chapter 38. But we're going to take a look at chapter 38, the story of Yehuda and Tamar, and really try to see what's going on in that story. It's a very troubling story. It's a difficult story to understand, but the ending is a great ending, and it's going to be that story that I believe unlocks the key to understanding everything in this week's parasha. So just to summarize very briefly what happens in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Yehuda gets married to the daughter of a man who's an Ish Adulami. He's a man of the Canaanite descendants. He marries this woman. And he also then gives to his, he has two children. The children's name are Er and Onan. These are their names. A little bit of a foreshadowing to what's going to be in their lives. And Yehuda finds a wife for his son Er. His son, he finds the woman called Tamar. That's her name. He marries his son Er to this woman Tamar. The Torah doesn't tell us what happens, but it just tells us that Er did wrong in the eyes of God. He did ra be'enei Hashem. He did evil in the eyes of God. And so God puts Er to death. Er dies. So what happens when a person in Jewish law, what happens when someone dies and he doesn't have any children? They perform what looks to be over here a sort of yibum kind of scenario. The commentaries over here debate this a little bit. Is there really yibum? Yibum is when the brother of the deceased, marries his deceased brother's wife. And the purpose of that is to uphold the name of his dead brother, that his dead brother's legacy should continue. He didn't have any children. And so there's a kindness here that the brother does for his deceased brother by marrying his wife to try and have a child to keep his legacy going.
It must have also been an ancient custom.
It's clearly an ancient custom. It's clearly something that dates back very far. Whether at this point you could say he was doing it by Torah law or maybe by social convention, you could debate that a little bit back and forth. But clearly there's an idea of this, because the roots of the story, the concept of the story, it runs through the entire story. So he gives Onan, the brother, to marry Er's wife. And here the Torah is very clear about what Onan does wrong. Onan refuses to impregnate his brother's wife. It says, v'shihet arza. He refuses to conduct intercourse with the wife appropriately in a way that will impregnate her. And so as a result of that, vayamet gam oto, God puts Onan to death also. So two brothers married to Tamar, each one dies. As a result, the text tells us, as a result of their sins, or Er's sins and Onan's sins, not Tamar's. What's important though is nobody knows that. These sins are potentially happening in private. So nobody knows that the reason why these two people who were married to Tamar died was because of their own sins. So as a result, what does Yehuda start to think? Exactly. There's a concept like this, by the way, in halakha. We call it isha katlanit. He starts to think that there might be something wrong with Tamar. Tamar is like a cursed woman, and anybody who marries her is going to die. And so Yehuda has a third son. His name is Shelah, but he's hesitant to give Shelah to marry Tamar, even though by law that would be, because he's spooked. He says that he thinks that Tamar is going to be the source of killing off his third son now if he gives it to be married. Yehuda does something a little tricky, okay? When he tells Tamar that I don't want you to marry my third son, he's not very forthcoming on this idea. The text tells us clearly that the reason why Yehuda doesn't want to do it is because he's afraid. He sees that the first two sons died, he's afraid. But when he tells to Tamar, he says, oh, my son Shelah is very young. He's not old enough yet. Wait as a widow on the side, and when he grows up, you'll marry the third one. He's doing a trick here, Yehuda. He's not being very forthcoming and honest in this scenario. The text is clear about that because it tells us what Yehuda is thinking and then tells us that Yehuda said something different than what he was thinking. So there's no, you can't really debate this. Yehuda plays a trick here on his on Tamar and doesn't want his third son to marry Tamar. Did I lose anybody yet? We're good so far. As a result, Tamar waits on the side. She accepts this. She waits on the side as a widow, and now she, a number of years go by, we don't know how many, but a number of years go by, and Shelah grows up and nothing happens. Yehuda does not give Shelah, as he promised, to marry Tamar. And so now Tamar is like, I'm not waiting anymore, I'm going to take matters into my own hands. She dresses up like a prostitute, she waits on the side of the road, and Yehuda, because she has heard that Yehuda is coming to visit the town. And so she waits on the side of the road and she seduces Yehuda. Yehuda now comes off of the road and Yehuda wants to sleep with Tamar. He doesn't know it's Tamar. She has her face covered. But he thinks, okay, the prostitute, he goes off, he wants to make a deal. And so he goes over to the side and he's talking now with Tamar. And Tamar says, okay, what are you going to pay me for my services? He says, okay, I don't have anything to pay right now, but I'll pay you a goat, Gidi Izim. I'll send you a goat through a messenger back to this place when everything is all said and done. She says, no problem, but I need a collateral. I need something to take to make sure that you'll send me the payment. Give me your coat, your stick, and your ring. I'll hang on to those things. When you send me the goat, I'll send those things back with the person. No problem. They engage in the act and they part ways. The text tells us that Tamar is impregnated from that cohabitation with Yehuda, but that's the only. She takes immediately after the act, she takes off her clothes as a prostitute, she dresses back in her widow garments, and she goes back to her regular home. Yehuda sends a messenger with his payment that he had to go find the prostitute that he was with, and they can't find her, obviously, because it was Tamar. Tamar is gone already at that point, but what is Tamar still holding? Tamar is still holding the stick, the ring, and the coat. She still has these three things of Yehuda's. Time goes by, presumably a few months, to which now it's noticeable that that Tamar is pregnant, and word comes back to Yehuda, your daughter-in-law Tamar became pregnant. Now what's going through Yehuda's mind? He didn't know that it was he who slept with her. He thinks she committed adultery. She was supposed to wait until I gave Shelah, until somebody else did. She's liable to be put to death. He says, burn her at the stake because she committed adultery. Tamar is being escorted out to her execution when she sends these three things to Yehuda. She sends the stick, the ring, and the coat to Yehuda. And she says in a cryptic way, right, in a under the rug kind of way, says, to the person who these belong, I have become impregnated. What is she doing? She's leaving the going to admit to his action, and Yehuda does in fact come to the forefront. It says, Tzadeka mimeni, she is more righteous than I am. Al ken lo netatiha leshela beni, I was wrong for not giving her to my son Shelah, and as a result, we avoid disaster, Tamar is not killed, and the text tells us of the fact that she bears twins. She gives birth to twin boys, Peretz and Zerah. That is the story.
Was it considered adultery because she slept with her father-in-law?
No, the opposite. When they find out that it was the father-in-law that was accepted, meaning it seems as though in those times...
Isn't it also unacceptable?
No, so it seems like in those times that the father could technically replace the brother, the one of the brothers in the act of Yibum as well, if it wasn't a brother. That's not the halakha for us anymore today. That's not the Torah's version of Yibum, but it is the version that we see in this story. That was accepted for her to do.
Yehuda was not upset with her that she tricked him. Like when I learned that in high school, everyone always asked that.
Why
was he upset that he was tricked? because he knew he did something.
I think he knew that it was on him. And really, Tamar is the heroine of this story. There's no question about it. It's very hard to paint Tamar in a negative light. Tamar is treated. We could look at this if we were really analyzing that story just by itself. Tamar is being treated as an object over here. She's not given the proper respect. When Yehuda wants to talk to her, he doesn't consult her opinion. He tells her what to do. She follows it. She's treated in a very negative way until the very end of the story. And so, it's hard to paint Tamar in a negative light over here. I think it makes sense why Tamar is doing this. She doesn't have any other recourse. It seems like any voice that she has is being squashed over here. So this is the story of Yehuda and Tamar. Very fascinating story. You could spend books and classes on just this story.
Take another wife after this?
So the text tells us that after this, he never had relations with her again. It was a one-time thing. She gives birth to the children. It says, "Velo yasaf od ledata." He did not continue to know her after that, which is a euphemism for he was not
but
continued to be married.
Children.
They are the children of Yehuda, certainly, because he was the one who impregnated her for those twins. Yeah,
so
absolutely. We're going to get to that. Yeah, that's the kicker at the end. So of all the things about this story, you could ask a ton of questions, but I think the question that we want to look at is, why is this story being placed here in the middle of the saga of Yosef? We opened with the three up and down roller coaster stories of Yosef. And right smack in the middle, the Torah wedges this story of Yehuda. What is going on over here? Why does the Torah put it there?
Just a simplistic question. Chronologically, does this fit?
So some commentaries say no. Some commentaries, the Ibn Ezra, for example, says this story happened much later on. The stuff with going on with Yosef.
It makes it more important that it's put here.
Right, not to mention, it makes it clear that there's a thematic connection between the two stories, not just a chronologic connection. Even the story itself, the Yehuda and Tamar story, seems to span a number of years because she has to wait to see if Shelah is going to grow up. He grows up and then he's not getting it. So the story itself takes place over a long period of time. And certainly stuff is happening with Yosef in Egypt while this story is probably going on. So yeah, chronologically, the story is seems to be out of order. It seems to be being put here because the Torah wants us to know something. It wants us to connect something with themes. Rashi makes this point. The story starts with the words, "Vahi ba'etahi," and it was at that time, "Vayered Yehuda me'etehav." Yehuda went down from his brothers. In other words, says Rashi, the brothers removed Yehuda from being the head of their clan. At that point, after they sold Yosef, who was going to take the reins of the family? It was going to be Yehuda who was going to take the reins of the family. When they saw Yehuda was the one who suggested selling him into slavery and the reaction of their father, they said, "Whoa, you let us down the wrong spot." Even though they were really all responsible, they blamed it on Yehuda. And so Yehuda was like ostracized from the family during this period of time, which could lead to why maybe his behavior is not on the up and up as we would expect it to be from someone of Yehuda's caliber. His rejection from the family may have led him on into his own mindset about, you know, the way in which he was acting until he snaps out of it at the end of the story. So there seems to be a connection here between these two stories thematically. And to draw that parallel, I want you just for a minute to take a look at page 2 on the bottom. I gave you a chart with three textual connections, and one of them is really chilling, will send goosebumps down your spine, about the connection between these two stories. As I showed you, the two stories start with a very similar language. The story on the right, Yehuda and Tamar, starts, "Vahi ba'etahi," it was at that time, "Vayered Yehuda me'etehav," Yehuda goes down from his brothers. The chapter right after, which talks about Yosef, "V'Yosef hurad Mitzrayim," Yosef was taken down to Mitzrayim. Similar ways of starting the story. Take a look at the story on the right, Yehuda and Tamar. There's trickery with a goat. There's trickery in the story involving a goat. Yehuda promises to give her a goat as the payment. She says, "Okay, I'll accept it," knowing full well that she's not going to. She takes his things instead, and the payment of the goat is never given. There's a little bit of deception here with the goat. "Vayomer anochi ashalach gedi izi menatzon," I'm going to send you a goat from my flock. That was what Yehuda said to Tamar. Well, in the story of the sale of Yosef, there's also trickery with a goat. Where was there trickery with a goat? What did the brothers do? They kill a goat, and they dip Yosef's blood, the coat, into the blood of the goat and show it to the father and say, "What do you make of this, Dad?" And he comes up with his own explanation. "Oh, Yosef must have been eaten by a wild animal." The brothers use this goat to deceive their father a little bit as to what really happened. And the kicker of all of it is the last one. In the end of each story, Yehuda and Tamar, it says, she is taken out. Himutzet, she was taken out. V'yishaleha el hamiha lemor. She sent to her father-in-law saying, "Le'ish asher elelo," to the man whom these belong, my ring, my coat, my staff, "anochi hara," I've become impregnated. Vatomer, she said to him, "Hakerna, do you recognize, please, lemi ha'chotemet v'ha'petilim v'ha'mateha ele," to whom do this stick and ring and coat belong? Who do they belong to? She's setting Yehuda up. The rabbis praised Tamar for this. She did not expose Yehuda. She had every right and every ability to come out and say, what's going on over here? It's him. Look, I can prove it. Look what I have. She could expose Yehuda. She doesn't expose Yehuda. And the rabbis say she was willing to die not to expose Yehuda. Had Yehuda not stepped up to the plate, she would have died. And she would have accepted that wholeheartedly. Tamar would have. That's the heroine and the tzaddiket that she was. But Yehuda does step up to the front. Look at the left-hand side when the brothers bring the bloody coat to their father. Similar words, bone-chilling words. Vayshalehu et ketonet hapasim. They sent the coat of stripes to their father. Vayaviu el avihem. They brought it to their father. Vayomeru. They said to him, Zot matzano. This is what we found. Hakerna. Same words. Do you recognize this ketonet? Who was the one who orchestrated this whole plot? It was Yehuda. Yehuda was the one who said to his father, do you recognize the coat? And he deceives his father with this recognition of the coat. In the story of Yehuda and Tamar, it comes back full circle to him. He's now being the one who has the opportunity again to deceive. He could deceive everyone and say, it's not mine. And let it go and hold on to his pride and honor and not admit to his mistake. Again with the same words, Hakerna, but he corrects his mistake. Yehuda steps to the forefront and he learns his mistake from the sale of Yosef. And it's at that moment that what does he get back? He gets back his ring, his staff, and his coat. Which person holds a ring, a staff, and a coat? What kind of person holds those things? A king. Yehuda gets back his symbols of being a king. It's at that moment that the kingship was given to Yehuda, in a sense. Because what is a king? A king is someone who has to recognize the suffering of other people. He cannot be somebody who stands on his high perch, who's arrogant, who conceals his own pride and cares only about himself and only about his kavod. He has to care about the people. He has to come down. He has to be humble. He has to admit when he makes a mistake. And he has to be someone who cares about the suffering for others. Yehuda missed that when he was hearing the screams of his brother from the pit. As he heard Yosef crying, don't sell me into slavery, don't sell me into slavery. And he ignored him. He didn't pay attention to the human being that was Yosef. He didn't recognize Yosef's humanity. And so he could deceive that way. He deceives his father. It's all about lack of recognition. He's not noticing the human element to who it is. That's how he treats Tamar in the beginning. He doesn't recognize Tamar as a tzaddiket, as a wonderful, righteous woman. He assumes the reason why his two sons died were because of Tamar, when really why did his two sons die? They died because of their sins. He doesn't recognize his own son's mistakes. He immediately assumes that it's on Tamar. It's not, all of these mistakes are piling up of lack of recognition on the part of Yehuda, until finally Tamar teaches it to him. And he has the courage, Yehuda, to admit his mistake, to become humble and to admit what he did wrong. And it's at that moment that he achieves the ability to become a king. The ability to take on that role of leading other people and recognizing the suffering of others.
I'm confused, but he's saying he recognized the coat. How is he telling Yaakov, this is Yosef and he's still alive. And where is he being, you know, the better guy here?
No, in the story of Yosef, he wasn't.
He
was not. In the story of Yosef, he was doing the wrong thing. He was trying to deceive. He was not recognizing. It's in the story of the Yehuda and Tamar, which happens right after that, that he corrects his mistake. His mistake comes full circle, and he's able to fix it. He's able to present. And that's when he earns his right to be the king at that point. And as Danielle pointed out, that's when we have what right afterwards? The birth of his two children, Peretz and Zerah, one of which is going to be the lineage of Peretz, is where David HaMelech comes from. That's where all of the kings are going to originate from. Comes from that birth, from that child. That cohabitation with Tamar is what results in the Melucha, in him attaining that level of being a king. So, yeah.
Can you say that that's why Yosef keeps rising and falling? Because he's not learning his lesson?
Okay, so that's how now I want to... When we understand the story of Yehuda and Tamar from that perspective, I think that that's how it sheds light on the Yosef story. Because Yosef is going through his own Yehuda excursion. He's going through his own up and down challenges with the same issue. The concept of the arrogance, the inability to recognize and become humble each and every time is where Yosef ends up falling until finally the fourth time it happens, he's able to learn his lesson. And now I want to go back and explore with you Yosef's journey in a little bit more detail to see where what was his problem and where he kept falling. So we're clear on what is happening here with Yehuda. So now just briefly, and this goes back to the point you were making before, go back to the first story. Yosef is brought into a position of leadership over his brothers. He had to have known that that created some sensitivity and tension in the family. He had to be aware of it. They tell him right out. It says straight out. Lo yachilu daberol l'shalom. They couldn't speak a word of peace and goodness to Yosef. His brothers were giving him the silent treatment, the cultural. They couldn't speak to him. If you're a brother and your brothers are not speaking to you, you recognize that. You understand that. You have to be oblivious to that concept. And yet, time and again, what does Yosef do? He tells them, listen to my dreams. Come hear my dreams. If you're reading the text going, Yosef, what are you doing? How could you be so blind to do something like this? And look what the brothers respond to him in verse number 8. I bolded it to you. They respond to him. They say to him, Hamaloch timloch aleinu? Are you going to become king over us? It's all about becoming king. Yehuda became king in that story. They're thinking in the beginning, is it going to be king? Who's going to be the ruler over all of the brothers? They think it's going to be Yosef. Yosef is making a very big point of telling them that it's going to be. What other interpretation is it? He's very happy telling them, I'm going to rule over you. And the brothers are not happy about this. Yosef cannot accept his position and not be arrogant and put it in his brother's face. And as a result of that, he falls the first time. That's story number one. Story number two, again, he rises to power in the house of Potiphar. And look at source number six. What does it say? Yosef has everything. He left all that Joseph had in his hands and with and him there. He paid attention to nothing save the food that he ate. And what does the Torah tell us right there? V'yehi Yosef yefeh to'ar v'yefeh mareh. Yosef was well built and handsome. Why does the text tell us that Yosef was well built and handsome? He knew he was very well built and handsome. The rabbis comment on this in the Midrash. They say Yosef started standing in front of the mirror and going like this and combing his hair and caring about his appearance in front of others. He knew he was good looking. Say, oh, you think you're good looking? You think you're going to be arrogant than that? What are we going to send you? Eshet Potiphar. Hey, you want to be good looking? Let's see where your good looks get you. Now we're going to send you a nice little test over here with Eshet Potiphar. And that leads Yosef again down back into the pit until finally, he gets the message when he's the leader of the jail, of all places. He finally recognizes, I keep getting these leadership positions, but each time I get thrown down. First I was the leader in the house of Yaakov. That wasn't good enough for me. Then I was the leader in the house of Potiphar. That didn't work out for me. Now God's telling him, you're the leader of the jail. Are you getting the point? You're the leader, but you got to learn how to lead. You got to lead with humility. You got to lead by taking care of the people. You got to lead not putting yourself in the forefront. Same message that Yehuda had to learn through the story of Tamar. And does Yosef get the story? He gets it. He finally gets it at the end in the third story. If you take a look at the story number 3 on page 2, look at verse number 6. He's in charge of everything in the home, in the jail. Vayavo alehim bab Yosef babokid. Yosef comes to see his prisoners in the morning. Vayarotam, he sees these two men, that's the baker and the wine, the Sara Mashkim, Vihinam Zoafim. They're sweating, they're anxious, they're nervous. Vaishal etzeri sefaro. Yosef takes notice of them. He cares about them. He asks them, what's going on? Why is your face bad today? And they respond to him, we have a dream and we don't know how to interpret it. What is Yosef's message back to them? Vayomer alehem Yosef. Yosef says to them, Halo lelohim pitronim. God can interpret your dreams. He takes the onus off of himself to a certain degree and puts it in the hands of Hashem. Not perfect even in this story. Look, he says, Sapiru nali, tell me your dreams. And then he tells the Sara Mashkim, remind me to Paro. He doesn't put his full faith in Hashem. But the process is starting here in this third story where Yosef is transitioning off of himself and his arrogance onto Hashem and giving everything into Hashem. And it's in next week's parasha when he comes in front of Paro at the final time that he's going to become, right before he's about to become king, where he tells Paro, it's all about God. God will tell you what to do. I have nothing to do with it. It's not about me. It's about God. God is showing you. God, 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 God. He's constantly mentioning God, taking everything away from himself. What's his reward? He becomes second in command. Now, says Hashem, you're ready to become king. When you recognize the idea that it's not about you, that you're an agent of Hashem, and that you have to care about everybody else and recognize other people and not only put yourself at the forefront, Now you're ready to be king. Now you're ready to own up and to be the leader of other people. And so everything here, the stories of Yehuda and Yosef being woven together magically by the Torah, masterfully by the Torah, is trying to lead us to the same concept. These two people, Yosef and Yehuda, are going to be the leaders of the Jewish people. All kings are going to come from these two people. There's two Mashiachs. There's the Mashiach, the son of Yosef. There's a Mashiach, the son of David. Yosef and Yehuda are the two prominent tribes that are going to work in tandem with each other. They're the two ones that are going to rise and step out above all else. They're going to be the leaders of the Jewish people. It's here that they develop the seeds for becoming the kings. Why do they have the right to rule? Because they learn the hard way through all of the stories that it's about caring for others, that it's about recognizing those who are suffering the lowest of the rungs on society, and understanding that you are an agent for Hashem, you are somebody that works for Hashem, and you put all of the glory and kavod in His hands, and you understand that it's not about you, it's not about your arrogance, it's not about your place, it's about what Hashem wants from you to be able to carry out His will. Any questions on that?
Not yeah. A question, just a
comment. Yeah, sure.
So the story about Yehuda and his double meaning of learning his lesson. So I recently learned that a similar situation happened to David.
With Bathsheba.
Right. But before that, when he was promised the wife, and then so
yeah,
he had this a similar type of thing. So it's like,
absolutely. And we see time and again, that concept is called Ma'aseh Avot Siman Lebanim. What happens one repeats itself. You can do this through so many different stories in Tanakh where the same trials and tribulations are coming up again and again. Take the story of Esther, for example. Esther and Mordechai are from the tribe of Binyamin, and they're having a struggle with Haman, who's from Amalek. Well, the struggle of Binyamin and Amalek takes place way before that. Shaul, the first time, is from the tribe of Binyamin. He's charged with killing Amalek. He doesn't do it. Mordechai and Esther clean up his mess, so to speak, way later on. All of these stories, there's a constant, you know, patterns. We have to look at Tanakh and these stories, you know, as with broad views as well as narrow views, zooming in on certain stories, but then also zooming out, taking a look at the bigger picture of things, because you see things repeat themselves time and again, over and over, similar ideas happening in all these different stories. And there's so much to learn, so much depth that you can gain out of them when you investigate them in a deep way.
Don't Yosef and Yehuda have very different qualities? I mean, it seems to be that you're saying that they went through the same things, they came out with the same results. Why the need for two?
I don't think that they...
There must be elements that of Yosef that Yehuda doesn't have. There must be elements of Yehuda and
Yosef. They definitely, they're definitely two different people, and they have definitely different character traits. And they express these character traits in different ways. I'm not saying that everything about Yosef and Yehuda is the same. What I'm trying to illustrate is that their trials, their stories, and what they're going through is all to get them to the same point of what it means to be a king, what it means to be a leader. Because Yosef and Yehuda are going to be the two ones that are going to be the leader. I think it's that story with Yehuda and Tamar that gives him the ability to step up to the plate and take care of his brother Binyamin. What gives Yehuda the courage to be the one who's going to take Binyamin down to Egypt and stand in front of Yosef, the ruler who he doesn't know is Yosef, and approach him and say, I need my brother back? What gives him that strength to be able to do it? It was the fact that he came out on top in the story of Yehuda and Tamar. When he persevered through that story, that gives him the strength. So my point here is that I think these two stories, as the Torah is weaving them together, are what allow them both to come out as these two prominent leaders at the end of the day. Yes, they have very different characteristics, and maybe some of the details of how they do and what they do are very different. I think they're taking a little bit of a broader perspective on them and how they get to their end point.
I'm curious if Yehuda always knew or always had that role. Like, we know Yehuda as the lion, as the leader. Was he born with that, and that's perhaps why he took affront to Yosef, or did he earn that right through this story? Because you see he's the one who's the most prominent in throwing competition
right
into the pit.
Right.
So I'm wondering, was he born with that?
It's a good question. I mean, it's a good question. It's hard to know from the simple text of the Torah. I mean, there's two brothers that seem to be the orchestrators of the plot to sell Yosef and throw him in the pit, and that's Reuven and Yehuda.
Reuben has the right as the eldest.
Right, so Reuben has the eldest right, so to speak, but it seems as though, and it's not clear why, the Yehuda has the ear of the brothers. The brothers seem to be following Yehuda's word. When Yehuda says, let's not kill him, let's sell him, the brothers buy into that, and they take Yehuda's plot, and so it seems like he has a lot of pull. As a result, he loses that pull when they see the reaction of his father, and then he gains it back again. So Yehuda's struggle to make his way up or not is something that we can chronicle throughout, right? And again, Reuven tries to be the one to take ownership over Binyamin. He tells his father, you could put my two sons to death if I don't bring him back. Yaakov doesn't accept Reuven. He accepts Yehuda's ability. So that could be a whole other class on the dynamic between Reuven and Yehuda. That's a whole nother topic you could explore. How come Reuven, as the birthright, seems to be shunned time and again, and it's Yehuda who seems to rise to the top above his brother Reuven? That's a whole nother question in and of itself.
Reuven,
we can look at that.
Step up.
Reuven steps up, but he steps up inappropriately each time. What do I mean by that? Right? Reuven steps up to the plate to save Yosef. But he falls a little bit short. Why? Because he tries to craft this plan. He tells the brothers, oh, throw him in the pit and he'll die in the pit. And then the Torah tells us, what was Reuven really thinking? He was really thinking, okay, they'll all leave and I'll go save him. But what does the Torah tell us? The Hachamim tell us. Reuven had the ability in his power, in his position, to say, guys, this is wrong. Don't do anything to him. And bring him back to his father. Reuven had that ability. But because he tried to finagle it in a way where he could keep his standing with the brothers and still save Yosef. He tried to get too cute, essentially, and he lost it, right?
Maybe in the story of Dinah, Shimon and Levi are the ones who are taking the reins, and like, where was Reuven?
That's a good question.
Where is he? He's not even there.
That's interesting. I didn't think about that. I didn't think about that. Where was Reuven in the story of Shechem and Dinah?
He's just thrown in with the rest of the brothers. He's the oldest brother. Shouldn't he be the one to say...
Maybe natural talent comes out, that innate... Some people just born with leadership qualities and some people just not.
Yeah. Reuven seems like he's trying too hard. Then again, he says to when he wants to take Binyamin, he tells his father, you could kill my two grandsons if I don't bring Binyamin back.
Yeah.
The most ridiculous thing anybody ever heard, right? But, I mean, I'm saying it in a very harsh way, but Reuven was trying to show how much responsibility he's willing to take, but the way he did it just didn't make sense. It didn't click in with Yaakov the way Yehuda is able to do it. So time and again, Reuven tries to take the leadership, but he's not able to do it. Maybe he's not born for it. Maybe it's not in his blood, and Yehuda kind of has to take it. Yeah.
Maybe that's why when Reuven sleeps with Bilhah, he's trying to like keep a low profile after that.
Reuven on his own. I mean, yeah. That story with Bilhah is. Forget about it. That like you can again, books and classes could be written just on that one thing. What happened? What really happened? How would you understand it? Reuven on his own is an interesting character. We really focused on Yehuda and Yosef. You could do a whole class on what Reuven's story is. Tracing Reuven's actions from beginning of the story to the end of the story. It's funny. Reuven is the one in Mitzrayim who tells the brothers. He goes, when the brothers when Shimon gets put into the jail and now they have to go back, what does Reuven say? Is it Reuven tells the brothers, you see, I told you when this guy, when he was crying in the pit, we shouldn't have sold him. It was Reuven who says it to them. What interesting, Reuven now takes like the high ground, like he's the moral code for the rest of the family. And I can imagine the brothers looking at him like, you didn't tell us that. You told him to put him in the pit. Like, what are you talking about, right? Reuven's now projecting his mental thoughts of what he really wanted to do outward to what he's telling the brothers to do. And the brothers are looking at him like, you didn't tell us that. You never told us to pay attention to him. You told us to throw him in the pit, right? What are you talking about? So all these things, it's incredible. It's fascinating to look at each character individually and trace him. But unfortunately, we don't have the time to do it all. Today, we focused on Yosef and Yehuda. And I think the point is, what does it mean to be a leader? How does a person be a leader? Through humility, through recognizing others, and putting Hashem first before yourself. I think those three qualities are key to understanding those two.
Thank you.
Have a great day.